Have you seen any Northern Lights action?
No, actually. And it's entirely my own fault.
No. Well.
Yeah. Because I've been aware that there's supposed to be some crazy Northern Lights. And the one night when I was like, oh, yeah, like, it's supposed to be super Northern Lights, it was like overcast. And then the kind of the next night I forgot. And then, yeah. Anyway, there have
was
you?
One, well, there was one night this past week. It was like a Tuesday or something. So a school night, a work night.
Yeah.
I think maybe I was cleaning up supper and Lisa had taken the kids to the park and she came home. She was like, let's drive to Cooking Lake right now.
Oh, and sweet. So
the kids like brushed their teeth and put their pajamas on and put fleeces on. And we just drove to Cooking Lake and it was a little bit overcast, but it was definitely the clearest I've ever seen the Northern Lights.
Wow. Cool.
It was like, almost like the whole northern half of the dome of sky above us was
painted.
Yeah. It was, like not a lot of really distinct shapes, but you could, yeah, there was reds and greens and it was cool.
Yeah. Got it. I got to take care of that. Such a good opportunity with all of the solar storms that there have been lately to actually check out some Northern Lights, which I haven't seen in quite a while. I have seen some amazing Northern Lights displays in my life, but yeah, probably not in the last decade. It's like I'm a city boy now.
That's the only place. I think that the only times I've seen them, I've been in the city.
Really?
In Edmonton, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, well, I grew up on an acreage like west of Edmonton. And we used to see them fairly often, like pretty vividly. So, you know, they're out here. We're north enough that it's relatively regular if you're in the right spots. But when I lived in Lake Louise, that was crazy. Saw some really good ones.
Oh, is that right? Yeah.
Yeah. Saw some really good, like, meteor showers too when I lived in Lake Louise. I don't know if there was like a specific meteor shower that was happening during that time, but yeah, there was a couple nights when we went out and watched and there was just like lots of shooting stars. It was awesome.
That's one that's this is just my own like anecdotal experience, but I've never seen a really wowing meteor shower. I've definitely like a few times in my childhood and a few times in adulthood specifically stayed up to try and see it. And I've seen shooting stars. I've never really seen like a wowing meteor shower.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah. I think it's pretty subjective. Like I've never seen one that's like lighting up the sky either.
Right.
You know, it's more like frequent shooting stars for an hour or something like that is probably the best thing that I've ever seen. But yeah.
Welcome to Food Court. I'm Alan Sutterby. I'm here with my good buddy, Shale McDonald. Hello, Shale.
Hey, Alan.
We're two chefs in beautiful Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. We love food and we love to talk about it.
It's probably the best intro we've done.
That was a
Edmonton beautiful
tourism.
Edmonton, Alberta, Canada.
Like it's a part of the showcase on The Price is Right or something. Yeah, you're going to...
Totally. Beautiful Edmonton. Can you imagine if that was a showcase? Who would be excited for that? Somebody. That would be the right showcase for somebody. But
yeah, maybe like I could see Alberta and they show pictures of Banff.
Yeah, but, exactly.
It'd be a pretty good April Fool's joke, though, for The Price is Right to play.
Man, that'd be so rough. And then nobody bid on it, and then the April Fool's joke went awry.
Mm-hmm. Well, say what you will about our fair city, Shale. Today was like a beautiful, it was like peak October. It was like great foliage, but everything, all the leaves just casting down.
Yeah.
It was gorgeous out today.
The day started like beautifully sunny, but then like turned to this like kind of fall, sort of overcast, kind of autumn-y kind of Halloween vibe or something.
Absolutely. Yeah. It was like a transition towards Halloween, even though today is Thanksgiving, but yeah.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. As we record, I guess this is Thanksgiving Monday, you'd call it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So tell me about your Thanksgiving, Alan.
The whole holiday weekend. Well, we do this thing where we don't do a really traditional complete spread, but we always get a turkey and we slowly consume it over several days. And so, like, for instance, we'll always roast some of it.
Turkey omelet. Turkey sound.
Sort of. Like, Lisa and I will have like a little bit of roasted turkey, mashed potatoes, and on and on. But like the kids just want schnitzel. They want turkey schnitzel and mashed potatoes. Yeah. So we did a few different turkey meals. But then the real highlight for us was today. We don't do this every year, but often on Thanksgiving Monday, we'll just bake a whole bunch of pies and then like put them in a wheelbarrow and take them to the park that's a block away from our house and invite a bunch of friends. So we had a bunch of pie and some port and some nice cheese in the park this afternoon. It was great.
Yeah, that's nice. I wish I could have come, but my family dinner was right around the same time.
In the middle of the afternoon.
Yeah.
Seems strange.
Kinda. I mean, we gathered in the middle of the afternoon. We didn't wind up eating until around 5:30 or something like that. Mm-hmm. My Thanksgiving is not very exciting, though, like these days. And I think it was like a COVID thing. Like we started, I think we had some, obviously just for at least 1 or 2 years, we had like a remote Thanksgiving kind of thing during COVID. And then I think like after that, it felt like we weren't sure whether everybody was going to make it or not. So we didn't plan a big dinner for a couple of years and we just ordered takeout. And I think I had kind of forgotten that like about a month ago. And I was going through my head about a month ago, like, oh, okay, like what should I cook for Thanksgiving dinner and yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. And then like about a week after I started thinking about it, my mom messaged me and she was like, where are we going to order from for Thanksgiving? And I was like, oh yeah. And then I was like, okay, maybe I don't want to cook dinner right now. I don't know.
Okay.
It's kind of sad.
So wait, what did you do?
Sounds like I'm lazy, but I actually did want to maybe cook Thanksgiving dinner this year. The problem is that like, I do wind up feeling like I get a bit burnt out in the latter half of the year cooking big meals because we have Thanksgiving and then it seems like right after that Christmas is rolling up. Mm-hmm. I don't know. It seems like, I know there's November in between, but for some reason the back half of the year seems jam-packed.
Yes. And so did you get takeout?
So we did get takeout.
From where?
Well, I think in the last couple of years, because it's kind of like having a turkey dinner, we've ordered from Swiss Chalet. We've ordered like roast chicken from Swiss Chalet. Also it's like one of my dad's faves. So it's nice. He gets to have a Swiss Chalet and we get to have what sort of approximates a turkey dinner.
Great. It's poultry.
It's poultry. Yeah, that's right. That's about the only thing that you can say that's similar about them. But
it's gravy.
I suppose.
Those potatoes.
Yeah. You can, yeah. I think they do have mashed potatoes. Usually people don't order them. But anyway, we tried to do that, but all of the Swiss Chalets were too busy, and so we wound up ordering pizza from Royal Pizza.
You got turned away from Swiss Chalet?
We did, yeah.
Wow.
There was no room at the inn.
Royal Pizza. You like that style?
Every once in a while, I do, for the nostalgia of it. I'm sure you're aware of this, but Royal Pizza has a pizza with spaghetti bolognese on it.
With spaghetti noodles and bolognese sauce?
Yeah, oh, you heard me.
Oh, okay.
I guess you're not aware of it.
I'm not sure I knew that. I think I've only eaten from Royal Pizza a few times in my life and not recently. But a
couple times, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it used to be kind of like a standard, like not holiday type family get together sort of meal that we would order. Mm-hmm. In fact, we went and ate a couple of family meals at Royal Pizza. But yeah, we haven't had it in a long time. I don't know if people just got sick of it or whatever. And that's probably good because I definitely would have gotten sick of it. But They also have a pizza that's called the Fred's Special.
Okay.
And it's pepperoni and mushroom and ham and pineapple on the same pizza.
All mixed together, not a half and half pizza.
No, not half and half, all mixed together.
That sounds like your heaven.
It's kind of hilarious and I kind of like it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I wouldn't think that, like, pineapple and mushrooms would go together on a pizza, and they kind of don't.
And they don't. I wouldn't think that they really do. And they don't.
But, like, sometimes you take a bite, and you get a bite of, like, pepperoni and mushroom pizza, and sometimes you take a bite, and you get a bite of ham and pineapple pizza, and that's kind of fun. And then sometimes you take a bite, and you get a bite of pepperoni and pineapple, which obviously, yes, for me, Alan, that's, like... The king of bites right there. But sometimes you take a bite and you get a mushroom and pineapple pizza and you're like,
And you're like, why did I do this?
Yeah. Why? Who invented this?
It's funny how like those, well, I guess especially those older pizza places where like you like their custom combinations and like their named like combinations when really you can go to, like you could go to Domino's and order
whatever you want. Yeah.
Yeah. But the ones that I think there was, I don't know, surely you ate there at some point, Shil, but like there used to be a pizza place in Garneau. Right now it's, for many years after it closed, it was where Transcend in Garneau was. Now it's actually an Indian restaurant called Nosh. But it was called Pharaoh's.
What was it called?
It was called Pharaoh's Pizza.
Yeah.
Duh. And Pharaoh spelt like, the Greek word for lighthouse, like Pharos, Pharos Pizza. Yeah. And they had, for instance, this one probably you can't order at Domino's, but they had a sweet corn pizza and it was just like this like thick crust, cheesy pizza that was just completely studded with presumably previously frozen corn kernels. But I like was obsessed with it.
That's funny.
And they also had a called it Popeye's special or something. And it was I don't even think it had feta or anything on it. It was just like this mat of spinach under the cheese.
Straight spinach and matzah.
And it was, I would get that sometimes too. But the sweet corn pizza was my regular order there.
That reminds me of Korean street food.
Oh yeah, totally cheese corn. Yeah, that's funny. I definitely would not have made that connection then. I definitely didn't know anything.
I don't think
about
they probably
Korean.
Were either. But no. There's definitely something going on there.
Yeah.
Corn and cheese is like a thing for sure.
And now across the street from there, that's where Mukjeong.
Yeah, yeah. You can purchase that sweet corn and cheese across the street at Mukjeong.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, which I went to not that long ago again.
Oh, is
it was good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's tasty.
Yeah. Had the tteokbokki. Which one? The rosé. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it was good.
Oh, is there? Sorry, the rosé? Like it's in a...
Yeah, it's like... Bechamel spice. It's like the regular spicy sauce, but with cream also or something.
Oh, really? Okay. That sounds good.
Yeah. Yeah, it was tasty. So, Alan, do we have any follow-up? Little bit, actually.
Oh, okay.
Embarrassing.
Why don't you just answer your own question?
So last time, I'm forgetting. We were supposed to have follow up about our follow up last time, and I can't. I'm not sure if
you don't mean the Mandela effect, do you?
No, we actually solved that one.
Right,
I think.
Okay. Yeah.
No, I was supposed. So my mom gave me a recipe to give to you,
right?
Which was
slushy,
right? Yeah, rhubarb slush.
Yeah,
and I was like, I don't know how, but like, I was convinced that my mom had put that recipe card in my hand, and I put it on my kitchen counter. Mm. And this isn't necessarily evident in the show as it exists, because I did a lot of editing to try and make it seem like I didn't run all over my house for half an hour looking for that recipe card in desperation, mm-hmm. So that I could like show it to you and talk about what it was while I was telling you about it. But I did run around my house for like 20 minutes looking for that recipe card and I could not find it. And I was like, where did I put it?
Right.
This is maddening. And then the next day I was like looking in my messages string with my mother, mm-hmm. and there was a picture of the recipe card. And I was like,
there was never a physical.
Did she just send that to me? And I like somehow like translated it into a physical object. Huh. And that's what happened. Apparently she sent me a text about it. And then I thought she had given it to me.
Interesting, because for the children who will never grow up with recipe cards, like that would never happen. They'd always be like, oh,
yeah,
well, it's a,
exactly.
It's a
they would never assume that somebody put a physical card in their hand. Yeah.
But okay. Rhubarb slushy. I love this idea because, yeah. Again, not every year, but sometimes my kids operate a rhubarb stand in the spring.
Oh, right.
Have we ever talked about this or no?
Yeah, I think so. I'm not sure if we've mentioned it on the show, but yeah.
They'll like make little, they're kind of like, I don't know, fledgling entrepreneurs perhaps, but they will like make little flyers. Like they'll make a picture and say like rhubarb sale, Sunday, May, whatever, June, whatever. And then we'll photocopy it and they'll like put it in their friends' mailboxes. And then they have a little table in our front yard and they sell bundles of rhubarb, and they always sell rhubarb iced tea as well. But rhubarb slushy, I don't know how well it would sell in May and June, but like they go roll up to the spray park in McKernan in July with a rhubarb slushy machine, like the ones that you can see the cycling slushy inside somehow.
Yeah, you just got to track down one of those slushy machines. Sure you can find one on, what's that, Marketplace?
Yeah, solar-powered slushy rotator, whatever it's called.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, all right.
Bicycle-powered slushy machine?
Yeah. Oh, that's a good idea, actually. Those? That would be fun.
Yeah.
Because then the kids would want to get on and get the kids
keep
at the park.
Slushy rolling.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You could, you could charge them like for a slushy by forcing them to ride the bicycle for like 5 minutes or something.
Yeah, like free small slushy for 5 minutes
of pedaling. Yeah.
Yeah. Slushy churning. Yeah.
It's a good idea, but you got to somehow figure out a way to make it seem like your kids came up with the idea.
Mm.
Otherwise, they won't want to do it.
I can incept that idea. That's fine.
Yeah, good idea. Incept it. Maybe you can do it without the whole dream contraption thing, though. That's going to have
to. Yeah, there's a way. Yeah, we can make it happen.
Leave a note under their pillow or something.
The small business fairy visited them with an idea.
I love that idea. Ugh, maybe the small business fairy is going to visit me someday.
You work for
How
a small business.
Would that be? I work for one, but I haven't started one yet. Yeah. So, Alan, what are we going to talk about? You want me to introduce it?
Well, we talked about how today felt like a kind of perfect turning point at Edmonton from we're leaving the season of the bountiful harvest and Thanksgiving, and we're now looking down the barrel of spooky season, right? That's what's happening.
That's right.
The leaves are almost gone. The skies are gray. There's an eerie chill in the alleys, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, it's echoing the Bunnyman season.
Wait.
It's the Cure season.
Didn't Echo and the Bunnymen do the Kids in the Hall theme? Or am I
No, that's Shadowy Men from a Shadowy Planet.
Oh, yeah, sorry. Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
My bad. Cut that out, please.
Oh my god, Alan, how embarrassing. and I don't know, that's a great segue, by the way, Alan.
Thank you.
I don't know if I've talked about it on the show before, but I try to, or at least for the last few years, I think for the last four I've done it, sort of like my own personal tradition is I'll try to watch a horror movie. I'll try to watch 31 horror movies during October.
Right. So odd. You're not, I love you. You're odd.
Yeah. Well, I think, I don't know. I don't know if I want to get into the whole story here, but I'm a bit of a cinephile. I really like movies. I grew up really loving movies. For a long time, I thought that I was going to work in movie making as a career when I was like in my late teens and early 20s. That was like my primary ambition. And I did take some steps in that direction, but they didn't really bear much fruit. And I wound up falling in love with cooking, which was like extremely surprising to me. But oh, maybe I have talked about this before because I think I talked about my career path before. So
yeah, in one of our origin stories.
Yeah. So, but like when I was young, I don't know if I just had like an overly active imagination or what, but like horror movies, like, I just, they scared me so bad. I would like not be able to sleep for like weeks, even from like the, what would probably be like the least scary thing, you know, looking back on it now. So there's a bit of a dichotomy, and like that, that lasted for a long time. Like I couldn't like really watch very many horror movies when I, even when I was in my 20s, they would still scare me really bad. I don't know.
Yep.
Anyway, sometime in like the early 2010s, some of the, like the best independent movies that were coming out and like the most sort of like original ideas and stuff were horror movies. And there was like sort of, I, you know, I think it always sort of existed. It just didn't really have a name, but like when a whole bunch of movies in this kind of genre started coming out in the early 2010s, like Hereditary and just like horror movies with like a bit of a deeper story and deeper, more like emotional context and stuff like that. They started calling them like elevated horror.
Okay.
And I really wanted to watch all these movies, but I was still like a little bit afraid to like watch them and then lose sleep over it.
Is a lot, sorry, just so I'm, we're talking about the same thing. Is this kind of like the A24, like, like these
that's
kinds
a big
of
part of
moves,
it.
Right? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. I think like A24 in a way sort of pioneered the elevated horror genre, but there are definitely other examples from other studios, but yeah, so I was like really interested in watching these movies because everyone was saying that they were really good, but I was a little bit afraid because I heard that like Hereditary, for instance, heard it was like really scary. Oh, like one of them also, and I don't think this is an A24 movie, but The Babadook is like,
yeah,
that came out like in a similar time, like maybe a little bit before Hereditary did, and I heard it was really good, and I wanted to watch it, but I started watching it one night when it was dark, and it was like so creepy, and I was just like, oh man, I am not going to be able to sleep if I watch this, so I gave up on it. And then I just like one day, like a couple of weeks later, I like watched it during the day so that I could like watch it and then recover afterwards, maybe like watch something funny afterwards to sort of like get it out of my head.
Right.
Long story short, I kind of started like doing a bit of like horror movie aversion therapy for myself. Like, I don't know.
By doing a
like
Clockwork 10
years
Orange
ago or
style,
something.
Like clipping your eyes open and forcing yourself to watch it, right? That's what you mean, right?
No, that's not what I mean at all.
Oh.
No, that's the Ludovico technique, not aversion therapy.
Oh, okay. Sorry. I don't know. Tell me.
Aversion therapy is like when people have a phobia. Oh, maybe it's not, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it's not called aversion. I thought it was called aversion therapy. Maybe it's called exposure therapy or something.
Okay.
But basically,
like the Bart Simpson line, like if you don't watch the violence, you won't get desensitized to it. Sorry, do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, that's basically that's like a really concise way to sum up what I'm about to get at.
Right.
Is like, yeah, I kind of had to desensitize myself, and I did that by like, yeah, watching movies during the day or some, you know, like, and then just trying to watch more horror movies than I normally would and expose myself to it more and kind of, you know, get desensitized to it.
Right.
And then so part of that was like, okay, I'm just going to try and watch a lot of horror movies in October because it's coming up to Halloween and it's fun to watch horror movies on Halloween. And so I'll just like, there's a lot of horror movies that I haven't seen because I didn't want to watch them. Mm-hmm. So I'll start like going through this backlog of horror movies. And so I've been doing that for a few years and it worked.
Right.
Somewhat unfortunately. Mm-hmm. It's like, takes a lot for a horror movie to actually like rattle me now. But anyways, that's a long way of saying thought it would be fun to talk about some food-related horror movies.
Yeah, which is kind of like now its own subgenre. Is that right? Like a,
I would call it
chef-inspired horror movies, chef-driven horror movies.
Yeah, exactly. Chef-driven horror movies. Chef-led horror movies.
Yeah, and is the menu responsible for this or?
That's a good question. I mean, certainly the menu is like the most well-known kind of recent, I guess, like, yeah. But it certainly fits. It certainly fits the genre.
Right.
In fact, it's probably like one of the better examples of the genre, I would say.
Especially because we're going to potentially talk about two movies tonight, right? And in terms of the actual treatment of the like and depiction of food and food ideas, the menu is like leagues apart from the ones that we're talking about here.
Big time.
Okay.
Yeah, I think like the menu, because we devoted an entire episode to talking about the menu, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there is a lot of like food related content to discuss in the menu, and maybe not so much with the two movies that we've selected to talk about tonight. And so it might be kind of a short episode, but I don't know. I guess we'll see what happens. Yeah. I don't know.
What are the movies?
Well, just before we get to it,
move it forward.
I'm always like deflating the forward
it's
momentum
like I have
of the
to
podcast.
Drag you kicking and screaming.
Screaming into the topic. Into yeah, exactly.
I'm just teasing.
No, I was just going to say that, you know, like I wouldn't say that the menu, like I would say that the menu is sort of like the high watermark for like food related horror, but like there is lots of other stuff. Like, have you ever watched the Hannibal TV show?
No, I haven't, but that definitely, I've heard a lot of stuff about it. And it definitely came to mind, comparing it to one of the movies
that we're going to talk about. Yeah. Anyway, like in that show, more so than in either of the movies that we're going to talk about tonight, there is like a lot of really amazing, like, cooking content, like really beautifully shot cooking scenes and very like accurate cooking scenes and stuff like that. Right. So,
and the thing, and not to put too fine a point on it, but the reason that the menu is so great is because the horror is say like the horror and violence in that movie is saying something about restaurant and dining culture.
But restaurants, yeah.
Whereas the ones that we're talking about tonight, like, I don't think any of it is meant as a critique or any kind of commentary
of restaurant culture
on food cooking, restaurant, fine dining, blah, blah, blah. It's just like, that's just kind of like the setting or like the, do you know what I mean? Like,
yeah. Like, I like 99% agree. I think so the movies that we're going to talk about are, one is called What You Wish For. And I hadn't heard about it until my brother recommended it to me this year. I think he watched it like by accident while like looking for horror movies to watch in October last year or something like that. And then another one called Chime, which is kind of a short, I guess, more than an actual full length movie. It's like 50 minutes long. So I guess that would be called a short, but like most short films that I've ever watched are more in like the half hour, like 20 minute, half hour, 40 minute kind of like, length, but yeah, it's 50 minutes. So it's definitely not a feature film, but it's a Japanese food related horror movie, so I thought it would be it's like a bullseye for the for the Venn diagram of the podcast. Great. So
can we start with that one?
Absolutely.
I don't like it.
Chime. Yeah, you're gonna come right out and give your review.
Are you about to give a synopsis? Is that what's happening?
I'll give a short synopsis as much as I can. I don't know. It's very what's the word? Non-linear or something? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
No, I guess it's kind of linear. I don't know. It's very... The narrative is like intentionally confusing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So
a lot of things that are not explained at all. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's like... I think when I warned you about watching it, I think what I said was... it brings up more questions than it answers.
Right.
Yeah. But I don't know. I think it's interesting. It's a Japanese, like, kind of low budget indie film, and it's centered around a character who is a cooking school instructor. Remind you of anyone else?
I was wondering if this was meant to call attention to, maybe you're trying to
necessarily, but you know, like there's definitely some crossover there. I thought you might have something interesting to say about that aspect of it. But basically bad things start happening in his class. And you can tell that the character, the main character, who's this instructor, he seems to be like under a lot of pressure and kind of like hiding that from maybe some of his coworkers and his wife. And so the first, like the opening scene of the movie, you kind of like, you're in class and he has this student who is like acting really strangely and in a disruptive way. And I think there's like a couple of days of classes, this student is like kind of acting out, not really listening to the instructor, and then winds up basically like slicing his own throat in the middle of the classroom, and everyone freaks out, obviously. And then and that's like really traumatic for the instructor, and he leaves for the day, and then the police come and ask some questions and things like that. And then yeah, it just sort of like keeps moving forward, but like bad things continue to happen. And I think like without going through and like explaining all of the story beats of the entire story, it like basically turns out, I think, that he is under pressure and doing things but hiding them from himself in a way or something. So like there's, I don't know for sure, but I think probably, like, I don't know, by the end of the story, I was kind of like, was he even a cooking instructor at all? Like,
oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. Like, or was that just a weird manifestation of his, in his own mind, and he was just like going around murdering people or something? I don't know. Was he like sneaking into a cooking school and murdering people? I don't know. But, you know, like there's a scene a little bit later on where he goes to a job interview, and it's like he's returning to a job interview at this restaurant, and he's been there a couple of times. And the owner of the restaurant is there, and the interview does not go well. Mm-hmm. Like he basically gives them really broad answers for all of the things that they ask him. They're asking him some pretty specific questions about what he wants to do with the menu. And he obviously doesn't really have anything planned. And he's just kind of like giving them these like broad answers like, oh, you know, like I'm going to make it authentic and, you know,
right.
really, yeah. you know, really do something original to bring in new customers. And they're like, okay, like what? And he just doesn't have any answers. And and the interview doesn't go well. And the manager and the owner of the restaurant like get up and leave. And at that very moment, another customer like goes and tries to attack some diners with a knife in the restaurant.
Yeah.
And he just sort of stands there and watches that take place, like after they've left him there, sort of at the table after the interview. Mm-hmm. And like that scene kind of gave me the sense that he was actually the one perpetrating it. Like he got frustrated in the interview and attacked some diners, but like he was just like watching it from the outside, and that's mm-hmm. what they show in the movie. I don't know. It's definitely a weird movie. It's definitely like very open to interpretation how it goes, but like you know, the end of the movie, like he has a wife and a child, but at the end of the movie they don't really say. Or does something happen with his boy?
The only plot point with his son is that the son asked to borrow money from him to finance a construction project that his friend is starting.
Right.
Is that
and
what you
he
mean?
Just turns, he turns him down.
And he turns
but
him
nothing
down.
Violent happens with the son, right?
No, nothing that we see, no.
Yeah, the end of the movie, he's all alone in his house and his wife and son aren't there and... it's like they were never there or something. Like, because they're always there in every other scene when he's in his house. And then, like, oh, and there's like this thing that there's like this running sort of, this running thing where his wife is like emptying the bottle recycling while they're eating dinner. And I think it's supposed to, like, you're supposed to get the impression that he's like annoyed by it or something.
It's very loud.
Yeah, but then in the end of the movie, he's the one that's doing it. And so I was like, oh, maybe he was the one that was doing it all along or something. Or maybe he, like, killed his wife and now he's doing it or something, you know?
Right.
Like, yeah.
There's something, like, the tone of the almost the entire movie and certainly the last half of it, like, it's just so dreadful, like, so laden with dread. I feel like it's easy for us to just try and like populate. Like, yeah, like, did he commit some heinous act against his family? I don't know. But like, there's, some just really strange and strained long shots of him, say, like, watching his son play
video
violence
games or
something. Yeah. And I found it extremely confusing because there was at one time I would be thinking like, is this like a possession movie, like a demonic possession? Because there's elements of that where it just seems like when he, like, whether it's in his classroom or when he's in the restaurant, it just seems like these acts of violence happen sometimes by his own hand and sometimes not. But then also a lot of it is like, it's a ghost movie. It's a haunting movie because the one of the students who, dies in his classroom seems to be haunting him and other instructors as well, right? Like there's another instructor thinks that she sees this girl who we know is dead, and then he sees her, and we don't see what he sees, but we see his reaction, and it's one of pure
terror,
he can barely breathe. And and so I didn't know left from right in this movie.
Yeah, for sure. And it obviously it's a little bit sort of like up my alley. It's Japanese independent kind of food adjacent movie. Like it's like right up my alley. But definitely, like, I wouldn't recommend it to anyone that like doesn't, you know, like that doesn't enjoy kind of
challenging movies,
like interpreting movies, you know, like it leaves a lot of stuff open to interpretation. And I think like that's not totally uncommon in Japanese cinema. In fact, I mean, like, Alan, have you ever seen Rashomon?
I don't think so. No.
It's like a very literal interpretation of what we're talking about. But it's like a classic Japanese movie by a director called Akira Kurosawa. And he's like a very influential director in the West. You'll hear like
he was Seven Samurais, right?
That's right. Yeah, Seven Samurai.
And this director's name was Kurosawa as well, but they're not related. I had to look that up because I was like, is this like Akira's son? I didn't understand. Sorry.
Yeah. Definitely not his son. I don't know if they're like
they're not related.
Not at all.
It says specifically on the Wikipedia page for the Chime director, he is not related to Akira
Not related
Kurosawa.
In any way to Akira Kurosawa. Yeah.
Yeah.
yeah, but Rashomon, interestingly, is like literally about a story that's told from multiple perspectives and like the interpretation in all of those perspectives. And, you know, like it's kind of left up to the viewer to determine what they think was the truth of what actually happened.
Okay.
So, and I, you know, like I'm not necessarily saying that this movie is like, you know, trying to pay homage to Rashomon in that way, but it, like, I think it is kind of fairly common in Japanese cinema for some things to be like left open to interpretation. Like, I've been watching also as part of my rewatches of horror movies, I've been watching like the Japanese versions of like The Grudge. The Grudge is based on like a series of Japanese movies that came out before The Grudge came out.
Okay.
And, yeah, there's just a lot of like, they are like ghost, I guess, movies. But there is a lot of stuff that is not ever explained. And it's like multiple stories kind of like cobbled together, like interspersed, and you kind of have to figure out what's going on. So, yeah, I think it's not uncommon for Japanese movies to sort of employ that technique to sort of like put the viewer off. Like off of their sort of to take them out of their comfort zone a little bit.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And this movie obviously does that like in a pretty blatant way because yeah, there are lots of things that are just never explained and it is completely wide open to interpretation.
And it's funny because I like, again, they're not really related except that they're both from Japan, but like in Spirited Away, or My Neighbor Totoro.
Oh, yeah.
There's all kinds of stuff that's not explained, but it's a fantasy. It's a playful fantasy. And so totally. I just like, am like, sweet, I'm strapped in and I'm along for the ride. And isn't that funny?
Yeah.
But in this context, I was like, but wait, what? But
I kind of thought it would be okay because like the reason why it was kind of, well, like I kind of thought it would be okay because it's 50 minutes. So by the time you're like, by the time you're like watching it, it's over, you know, like in a way. And, but that was also a little bit frustrating for me because I was watching it and I was like, oh, okay, like maybe I'm seeing what's happening here. Like maybe he's crazy and he's seeing this stuff happen and just like taking himself out of it or something, hallucinating that it's happening around him and he's not perpetrating it or something.
Right.
And, you know, like, and then by the time I was formulating that idea, the movie was over. And I was like, oh no.
Right. It's okay if there is food and culinary arts in a movie. Like, the movie doesn't need to be about food and culinary arts, but there were a couple small things that came up where I was like, oh, they might actually be saying something about food. And one was when I think it must have been after that first troubled student killed himself in the classroom when an investigator is talking to the instructor. And he asks him specifically, like, do you find that like being in the kitchen and people like handling knives and, you know, prepping food, does it make them, does it put them on edge? Like, I can't remember exactly how he said it, but like, and the instructor said, no, to the contrary, like it seems to have a calming effect. And even though we're working with blades and sharp objects and heat and everything, like people are generally very calm in the kitchen. And I think they address that again later. Maybe because the instructor has a cut on his hand that the investigator points out or something, but.
Right.
And I didn't know, I don't know. That's kind of a little bit philosophical, or I didn't really know if there was a serious point there, but
Yeah, I don't know if there's a serious point there as it pertains to the rest of the movie, but yeah, it was an interesting piece of dialogue, and I liked that. I think like it's interesting because that's how it was portrayed too. Like the cooking class is like very calm and like,
yes,
you know, he's giving instruction, but he's speaking like very softly, yeah, and you
there's
know,
lots like of chatter, just, and it's not like a,
yeah,
this doesn't seem to be like a post-secondary cooking school. It seems like a con ed kind of thing,
right,
or something.
Right. Yeah, yeah,
like
yeah.
These aren't people who are going to work in industry. Like it seemed that kind of chill.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
Anyways,
what
it was an interesting
school is like. But.
Yeah, I have no idea. It was an interesting conversation. It didn't seem like, you know, it seemed like the kind of conversation that would only happen in an art house movie, or maybe that's how they talk in Japan. Maybe that's how they investigate crime in Japan. I don't know, but it was very philosophical.
Yeah, it was. I think like that. Yeah, that was another thing about it. So yeah, there's a detective who clearly is pretty suspicious of this instructor. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I think he's using a little bit of interrogation technique there to try and get an emotional reaction out of the instructor, maybe.
Right.
And yeah, I really enjoyed that, the like character of that detective, mm-hmm. because I don't know, like, yeah, I don't know, he just felt very, I don't know, a lot of the Japanese media that I've been following, you know, like a lot of the conversations are like indirect, you know,
okay,
a lot of the communication is indirect, but it's like there's subtext and everyone understands the subtext or something like that. And yeah, I thought that investigator did a good job of like asking questions that would make it seem like he was, you know, on the surface, he's just like asking out of curiosity,
right.
But that if you're the person on the receiving end of that question, you're like, oh, he's on to me.
Yeah.
You know,
love a good detective character. Yeah, totally.
Totally.
Sorry. This is not part of our mainline conversation, but have you watched Ripley, like the Netflix
No, I haven't. I've been considering it though.
Such a wonder, like, did you see the movie, like the 1999 movie with Matt Damon and stuff?
Yeah, I did. Yeah,
it's so different. It's so right. different, and the inspector character is amazing in the Netflix one. So good.
Like, cool. Yeah, I've been wanting to watch it because I heard it was really great, but mm-hmm. I just haven't gotten around to it yet. Will do. Now that I know that you've watched it, Alan, I'd love to watch it so we can talk about it.
It's not very much food in it, just so you know, but...
Yeah, fair enough. We won't talk about it on the show, I promise. Anyway, that's Chime. I don't know, like, listener, if you're interested in Japanese cinema, independent Japanese cinema, and you don't mind, like, sitting through a movie that forces you to interpret what's going on, then... I enjoyed it. I thought it was like, it's like really short. It's easy to sit down and just like, you know, by the time you eat a bowl of popcorn, it's over. So, but yeah, I don't know. There was some really, I don't know. There was like some, it, yeah, it's sort of like the op. Well, I don't know. There is stuff like this in Miyazaki movies too. Like, you know, like, just like, things happening, yeah, like the taking out of the recycling, and it's very loud, just like these things that happen that cause a sense of foreboding, mm-hmm. and I thought it did a really good job of using that kind of stuff to build tension as well.
Yeah, it's a for all that I've criticized it, it has such a unique artistic sensibility. Like, for instance, like the whole landscape and the, like, I don't know where it's exactly in Japan it's meant to be, but like,
right, yeah.
It's like so gray. Everything is gray and white and gray and black. Like it's shot in color, but I just mean like the landscape.
Yeah. But the palette, so, the color palette is just everything is gray. Yeah.
And yeah, you get this kind of like this, oh, I hate to use this word, but this juxtaposition of like dreary, monotonous day in, day out grind. But then like this really awful dread and anxiety. Yeah.
And then splashes of red blood on white cloth, you know, like it's
right. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. But some really, some good vibes in it. Like some, sorry, not good vibes. Yeah. I mean like some eerie, really well orchestrated vibes.
Some good vibe building.
Yeah. That's what I'm trying to say. Yeah. Not good vibes. Too violent.
No, bad vibes. Bad vibes.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know. If you're interested in it, I think it's worth seeking out. It is kind of, I don't think it's on any streaming services. But I think, like, I don't know. I think you can rent it and or find it fallen off the back of a truck somewhere. If
just go to Blockbuster, is that what you mean?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. I'm sure if you do a couple Google searches, you can find a place to watch it. And if you're really curious and desperate to watch it and you can't find a copy, well, I guess drop us a line on Instagram. I can try and help people find a copy of it if necessary. And then the second food-related horror movie that we watched is called What You Wish For, which I had never heard of. And I assume you had probably never heard of either, Alan?
That's right, yeah.
Yeah. And as far as I know, my brother is the only person that I know who has ever heard of it either. So, like, I don't know. It is pretty, like, indie, like, pretty low budget. But it's shot on location in South America, so it's definitely like a movie, you know? Like, yeah.
I think there was only one actor that I recognized. And I couldn't even tell you her name, but the woman who played Imogen seemed very familiar to me.
Oh, yeah. She seemed familiar to me. I think I knew I'm not 100% sure, but I think, so there's the sort of the lead character, I guess, is a chef. And he's played by a guy named Nick Stahl. And I definitely have seen that guy in some stuff before. I'm not positive, but I think he may be like a Canadian actor. I think he might be like somebody that's like in the Vancouver kind of like TV acting scene. And he's been in some like shows like maybe
Breaker High.
I don't know. Like the X-Files might be too old for him to really be playing like characters in, but maybe like some of the shows that came after the X-Files, like Fringe and stuff that was shot in Vancouver. I think I recognize him from some of that stuff. I'm not sure. And I definitely recognize the actor who played his friend who invites him to this house as well. I recognize that guy from somewhere, but I'm not sure from where. Yeah. So I guess I'll give a little bit of a synopsis.
Sure.
So it's about a chef who looks like he's going on vacation. He's, I guess, been invited to this villa somewhere in South America by a friend of his who he hasn't seen in a really long time, who is also a chef. Looks like it kind of seems like they worked together, or grew up chefing together or something like this.
I think they said they went to culinary school together.
Yeah. Okay. Right. At the CIA? I don't remember.
They didn't say. And they were roommates.
Right. So yeah, the story opens with these two guys kind of like hanging out. And the friend who invited the main character, we need names for these people. I don't suppose you jotted those down, did you, Alan?
So Jack is the name of the chef friend who invited the friend. He was staying in the villa in South America. His name is Jack. And then when his American friend arrives, his name is Ryan. Like he has a driver waiting for him at the airport.
So Jack invites his friend Ryan to this villa in South America. And Ryan goes and he gets there and they're kind of hanging out. And Jack starts telling Ryan about why he's there. And it's to cook this like fancy dinner for like really rich people. So apparently he has a job where a group of like really rich people fly him around to like houses, beautiful houses in various parts of the world. And then he like puts together a meal like for a small group of people. And then they all, you know, pay to fly there and have like a meal that's cooked by him. And he's supposed to be like a really amazing chef. And there's like some kind of notes of jealousy from Ryan. You know, he's been having a tough time, I think, like cooking back home.
He works at a Marriott in Dallas.
In Dallas, yeah.
So that's the, yeah.
Yeah, and then they start dropping notes that like Ryan's run into some money problems, ostensibly some gambling debt or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah, there's a little bit of like desperation on the part of Ryan. He's obviously having some like financial problems, and he sees that his friend Jack is like, you know, living the high life and being flown around the world to cook these fancy meals. And he keeps sort of saying, Ryan keeps sort of saying to Jack, well, you know, like if you need a sous chef or if you need somebody to help you out with this, like I'd be happy to like jump in and help out. And Jack just sort of keeps deflecting that idea and saying, you don't want to be involved in this. There's like downsides and, yep, you know, and I don't really want to get you involved. And they're kind of hanging out for a couple days, and they sort of have, they wind up in some kind of like dark conversations. And it seems like, you know, Jack is really, although he's like involved in this, like what seems like kind of a dream cooking job, it seems like he's really, kind of depressed about it.
Mm-hmm.
And really like, you know, trying to not say too much about it, but at the same time, like saying that it's not all it's cracked up to be.
Mm.
And, you know, that sort of just keeps like spurring Ryan's curiosity, I think. And, he starts kind of like snooping around the house while his friend is like away, and finds out, he like snoops onto his friend's laptop and finds out that he's got like a bank account with like couple million dollars in it or something, and he's like, euros, whoa, this, yeah, is crazy.
Mm-hmm. Or pounds, yeah, sorry, it was like, yeah,
million, yeah, a couple million pounds. Yeah. yeah so this kind of this is sort of like the first like 30 minutes of the movie or so. They have a night of drinking, and the next morning Ryan wakes up and he finds that his friend Jack has killed himself. No explanation, no note, really, or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then he gets the stupid idea of, like,
Tom impersonating.
Him. Yeah.
Stealing, yeah, his identity, right? Yeah.
Stealing his identity. So, I mean,
which sounds
not
really
like
silly,
a good guy thing to do.
It sounds like, and one thing, the only reason that it really makes, well, The reason that it makes sense in terms of the story is that we find out that it is gambling debts. Right. And actually, Ryan has partly come on this trip to get out of the United States because of his debts.
Yeah, because his life is in danger.
And yeah, whoever he owes money to is threatening the life of, like, they're sending Ryan pictures of his mother on her front porch, insinuating that they'll harm her if they don't get their, yeah, money soon. And so, like, in that con, it's not just like a harebrained, like, well, it'd be nice to have this life. It was like a,
yeah,
it was,
no,
a,
you're
pretty
right,
serious,
there's definitely desperation there that pushes him to, yeah, do this like bad thing.
Yeah.
But yeah, then basically he hides his friend's body and figures out a way to impersonate him and get like identification to like gain access to his bank accounts and things like this. And while he's in the middle of making this plan, some people show up to the house. Clearly, like the people that Jack was meant to be meeting there to cook this dinner. And they kind of catch Ryan by surprise. And Ryan just tells them that he's Jack and that he's there to cook their meal. And they're like, you know, and they're asking him about it. And this is the part of the movie that I found extremely awkward, but they're like asking him about the dinner because he's the chef that's meant to be there cooking it. And he is basically telling them that he has no idea what he's there to do.
Yes.
And they somehow don't take that as like a major red flag.
Yes.
And they just keep like going along with it.
Mm-hmm.
And filling in the details for him. So, like, he doesn't know how many guests are supposed to be there. He doesn't know if there was a menu planned. He doesn't know
how much he was supposed
to get paid. He, yeah, doesn't know. There's, like, yeah, a lot of information that he really should have had that he doesn't have. And I don't know. I suppose you can like explain it away by saying that they were suspicious, but they knew they needed a chef, so they just played along. But I don't know.
Yeah, I think that you're right. That is the one part that did not ring true within the world that was created in the movie, because
yeah,
the more you learn about the people who organized the dinner, like they wouldn't, there's no way that they would
take those kind of risks.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. And also it seems like they are very well informed.
Yes.
About everything that goes on, and the planning is like exceptionally detailed. So yeah, it seems impossible that they wouldn't know what the chef was going to look like. But anyway.
Right.
You come to find out that they are planning extravagant meals for people who want to eat humans. And part of Ryan's job is going to be to find a human for them to cook. And yes, he doesn't realize this. And then the story just keeps progressing. You sort of find out progressively that there is just absolutely no way for Ryan to extricate himself from this situation without being killed. And so everything that is supposed to happen with this dinner winds up happening. And along the way, the police become involved and it gets really tense. I think, yes, you know, like the movie definitely has some strengths. I think it has some strengths and weaknesses. One of the weaknesses is like sort of, you know, those kind of like plot holes that I didn't really feel, you know, made sense. Yes. Some of its strengths are, I think it's like kind of bits of it are like a pretty fun slasher movie, you know, like,
oh, absolutely. Like it,
there's like some surprising, like gory, like bloody attacks and things like that, that you're not expecting. And that just like are really caught me off guard. And I thought were like, and I think the movie sort of has a sense of humor about the subject matter.
Yes, in a surprisingly subtle way. Like it, like I was thinking, so it really reminds me of Get Out. I don't think as artful as Get Out, but the in right. terms of that balance of horror, thriller, and humor.
Right.
It reminded me of, and if I had to, what's that? I don't know. We've talked about this, like, when you have to explain movies, like it's kind of like this movie meets this movie meets this movie. This is Get Out meets The Most Dangerous Game meets The Talented Mr. Ripley.
Right.
Like it's just an amalgam of those three, like in a kind of clever way. But
that's like a trope from a movie called The Player, which I believe is directed by Robert Altman, but it's like about Hollywood executives.
Right.
And that's like a game that they play in that movie. It's like, oh, it's like this movie on this movie on this movie.
Right. Or whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think another one of the movie's strengths is like that basically everything is sort of shot on location. So it feels very alive. It feels like very real. You're like in real locations. Like there's very little in the movie aside from some like really bad driving shots where it's obvious that they're like driving in a car with a screen behind it.
Mm-hmm. Like it looked like a Bond movie. Like it looked like a 1960s.
Yeah, it looks like an old Bond movie. Yeah. Yeah, it was pretty rough. But yeah, generally, like the look of the movie feels very authentic, and like, you know, the house that they're in is like very beautiful, and the scenery is very beautiful, and it's shot pretty nicely. Like I wouldn't say that the cinematography is like groundbreaking, but you know, they do pretty well with what they have, and they, you know, and they have a lot of natural splendor to shoot, and that works out really well. I think the food content in the movie, like stepping out of the idea that like it winds up that, you know, they're cooking people, or he has to cook people for this dinner. I would say like the food, like the menu and the shots of the food being prepared, some of the shots of the dishes are like pretty nice. Like mm-hmm. somebody like obviously styled the food pretty well for the dishes that were going to be like placed on the table, but just like the actual like shots of like anything having to do with cooking or anything like that were really pretty bad.
Pretty laughable, I would say. Actually. Like,
yeah, pretty laughable.
There was a little bit of kind of like a big night flaw going on here where this guy is meant to be preparing an extravagant multi-course meal for the for the ultra wealthy, and he doesn't even start anything.
Until like nothing, like not a single ingredient has been like worked on at all, and they actually say in the movie that it's 3 hours before they're going to serve dinner, and he's like,
first course.
Oh, well, I better get cooking then, I guess.
and then while he's cooking, there's all, just like Big Night, which I like Big Night, but it's just like, you know, people just like swoop into the kitchen and start talking to him, and he'll put down his knife and start chatting with them. And there's these scenes where it's during service. And I know it's only five people, but like they've intentionally ratcheted the tension so high. You'll look at his workspace and he'll literally have a cutting board, a knife, and one ingredient.
Like one ingredient.
And there's nothing else going on. There's no pots on, there's no plates out, there's nothing. And so it's like, again, I know it's not a movie about food, and food just happens to be in the movie, but it's like, those scenes were actually laughable to me.
Yeah, it was pretty terrible in that way. Yeah, and I don't know, like, you know, the rest of the movie, I guess, like, you know, most of what the movie has to say thematically is like about classism or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, there's like, they're in a third world country, and somehow they've justified the idea that they can like take the life of another person to like provide this experience for like these rich psychos or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're willing to write that off because, you know, well, you know, we contribute to the community while we're here, and we give them lots of money, and we built a school, and, you know, there's like a lot of weird classist stuff going on, which I think is kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. You know, and then there's obviously a bit of like a spy intrigue vibe going on. Like, you know, there's like this kind of evil organization or something,
the agency.
Like the agency is like this conspiratorial organization who like knows everything about everyone, and they're inescapable, and once you're in, you're never out, and and all of this kind of like, you know, all of these kind of like spy movie type of pressures or whatever,
and even like in the like this kind of cabal, right, of ultra wealthy people who control everything.
I don't know. I had fun watching it. I think, you know, if you're looking for something fun to watch and you're not totally turned off by the idea of, this is kind of the problem, actually. Unfortunately, like a large portion of the like horror movies or horror shows that involve cooking, wind up like at least dipping a toe into cannibalism,
right?
Which, I don't know. I don't love that. I can understand why, if you want to make a horror movie about cannibalism, that maybe cooking or food would wind up being a part of like the setting or whatever. So I guess that just sort of is the way that it is. I watched another like horror movie. I didn't know that it really involved cooking, but I watched another horror movie last year, and I can't remember exactly what it's called right now. But it was like more of like, you know, an abduction, like a woman is abducted by a man and like, you know, put in a dungeon in this house. And then he tries to do the, like, what's that called? When people fall in love with their
Stockholm syndrome.
Stockholm syndrome. Yeah, he tries to like manipulate her into having Stockholm syndrome or something like that. But there's like, it winds up being about cannibalism as well. And you find out halfway through, and I was like, yeah, okay. So it's kind of unfortunate that, you know, most of the horror movies that involve food in any kind of like real way also wind up involving cannibalism. I guess it kind of makes sense, but like, I don't know. I don't.
The menu didn't.
No, the menu didn't. And that's honestly, like, that's a big part of, well, you know, like, it doesn't for very good reason, because the story isn't really about that. But, like, that's kind of what makes it stand above to me, you know? Mm-hmm. It's about the other horrors of of cooking in the service industry. Mm-hmm. Anyway, What You Wish For. It's got kind of a unbelievable but kind of cool ending. Like, yeah, I don't know, I kind of like the way that it ended. It was I found it interesting.
Yeah, I really liked the ending.
You know, it puts the main character basically directly in the shoes of his friend who was really trying to warn him away from it, and just like, it really lays out exactly why that guy wound up killing himself. Like, you find out by the end of the movie exactly what kind of situation he was in that would force him to do that. And yeah, unfortunately he dragged his friend into it.
Okay, so actually, and that reminds me, I did not think this at the time at all, but I hadn't had the big plot twist revealed to me yet,
right?
But Jack, it was Jack, right?
Jack is the friend who invited Ryan.
Did Jack invite Ryan there with this in mind, for Ryan to kind of take his place?
I think so.
Okay.
I think so.
And why did he do that? Why didn't he just end it and be done with it?
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know. I think maybe he wasn't sure. And I think maybe he thought that having Ryan there would help talk him down, or like, you know, or something. Like,
but they said maybe that they hadn't seen each other in 12 years.
Yeah.
So it just seems like such a intentional thing.
Well, and I think, I don't know, like, I think part of it was that Ryan reached out to Jack, and I think Ryan reached out to Jack because he was somebody he knew who lived outside of the States needed to get out of the country. Mm-hmm. So I think it wasn't like totally intentional that like Jack just invited Ryan for kicks or to replace him or something. Mm-hmm. Because it would make more sense, like, if he had invited him to replace him, it would have been made more sense if, when Ryan was asking him, hey, do you need a sous chef? Like, he would have been like, oh, maybe I do need a sous chef.
But I liked, to me, the ending was a very, like a very contemporary horror ending, where like in an old horror movie, like, The Exorcist, say, like the ending of that movie is the priest sacrifices himself to get the demon out of the little girl, right?
Yeah.
But the ending of a modern horror is like, nope, it just keeps going forever.
Yeah, exactly. The horror continues.
Yeah,
and we're just gonna live with the horror from now on. That's what the ending of The Babadook is like. It's like, yeah, it's still horrific. There's still the thing that has been terrifying us is still happening, but now we understand what it is and we realize that we have to live with it. And so that's just our situation.
But now, at least that one, like The Babadook, had a nice, like, it was a story about motherhood, basically, right? Like, it was it had like this perfect kind of thematic analogy. But this one, the end of What You Wish For, is like, no, like, you're trapped in this and it's gonna happen again and again and again
unless you do what your friend did and decide that to end your life because it's that bad. So yeah pretty rough. But again, if you're looking for like a food related horror movie, if you're looking for something to watch around Halloween and you're interested in food related movies, well, I mean, you could do worse, I think. It's pretty fun.
Just watch Ratatouille.
Yeah, it's just not scary though. Oh. I guess neither of these movies are really scary either. Or maybe I'm just too desensitized now.
I think that's it.
Did you find them scary, Alan?
What You Wish For is it's a thriller, and yes,
it's like psychologically kind of haunting.
Yeah,
or something.
And it did really like, honestly, once the main twist is revealed, I was genuinely interested in what was going on. I felt like some of the conversations, like you mentioned, like the dark conversations that Jack and Ryan have late at night. To me, those like seemed really corny to me when I was watching them.
Yeah.
But then like once you understand what Jack's actual job is, and then it all starts to make so much more sense.
Made a lot more sense.
And I was truly engaged from that point on. And then once the dinner started, like it was a thrilling show.
They did a good job. Like I think like, you know, they really, you know, they did that thing where, you know, you're in a situation and things seem tense and you're like, oh man, how are they going to get out of this one? Mm-hmm. And then it just keeps ratcheting up and the situation just keeps getting more and more like during when they're cooking this dinner, the police show up at the house and there's another pretty good detective character, which I thought was like kind of cool. Yeah. And like he winds up asking if he can ask the diners some questions, and then one of the diners like is getting a kick out of the fact that the cops are there because it's like giving him a little extra rush, so he asks the detective if he'll like sit down and eat dinner with them.
Yes.
And then they are like having this like really weird dinner conversation where the detective is like trying to like, you know, find out, like trying to get somebody there to like accidentally spill some information, and everybody's like kind of dancing around things and and like pushing things a little bit with the detective, and that kind of is like ramping up the tension a little bit more. And then, you know, bad things are happening like elsewhere in the house that if the cops saw them, like,
yes,
you know, the jig would be up. And it was pretty fun. I thought it was a pretty fun watch. But yeah, certainly like not the kind of thing that was going to like cause me to lose sleep or like, you know, made me think that, you know, I don't know, like the kinds of fears that I used to have when I was scared of watching horror movies, I don't think this would have caused those kinds of fears. It's like, you know, fears of like dark places and stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
And it will, I really, really don't want to talk about the specifics of what was served at the dinner, but like a lot of that was like cringeworthy, like, sorry, cringy in a way that like, that kind of stuck with me for a couple days afterwards, but
yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although also like, I don't know, really weird and not, I don't know.
Didn't make very just, much
like food. Seemed very made up. Like, yes. I don't know. Kind of. Yeah.
The dessert was complete nonsense. It didn't make any.
Yeah. Complete nonsense.
Anyways. Yeah. I don't want to talk about
it. The menu didn't make much sense at all. And it was derivative. And
they did this at 11 Madison Park 10 years ago. Come on. I'm sorry.
Hey, listeners. You can help support Food Court and access great bonus content by joining our Patreon at patreon.com/foodcourtpod. If subscriptions aren't your thing, you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. Food Court is recorded in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. Your hosts are Alan Sutterby and Shale McDonald. Theme music by Ryan McDonald. To get new episodes on the day they're released, follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your favorite podcast player. We love to hear from you all. Please drop us a line at feedback@foodcourt.fm or find us on Instagram @foodcourtpodcast. We'll be back in 2 weeks with a fresh new episode. Thanks for listening.